It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, George Floyd was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer 2 years ago today. A former Wisconsin police chief joins the show to talk about the state of police reforms since then. Now, the nation is mourning the loss of 19 children and two teachers who were killed in the shooting yesterday at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. It follows a long string of school shootings, including the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, nearly a decade ago. President Biden called on lawmakers to, quote, stand up to the gun lobby, end quote, and take action to prevent these tragedies.
And don't tell me we can't have an impact on this carnage. I spent my career as a senator and a vice president working to pass common sense gun laws. We can and won't prevent every tragedy, but we know they work and have positive impact. When we passed the assault weapons ban, mass shootings went down. When the law expired, mass shootings tripled. The idea that an 18-year-old kid can walk into a gun store and buy two assault weapons is just wrong.
More details are still coming out about what led up to the shooting in Uvalde. Our guest today has reported extensively on survivors of previous school shootings and the impact of this gun violence on children and their families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has the news of this latest shooting affected you? If you're a parent, do you worry about your child's safety at school? Do you try to talk about it with your kids? If so, how? What questions do you have about the impacts of school shootings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Woodrow Cox is an enterprise reporter at The Washington Post, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You talked and you wrote about your conversations with survivors of some of those past shootings, John, and their reactions to that news out of Uvalde yesterday. What kind of things did you hear from, you know, people who had survived these shootings as children and families who lost their kids in those past shootings?
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly a sense of shock. There was anger. There was a deep sadness, but largely there was not surprise. You know, this is a thing that they knew could happen again and inevitably would. And here we are, right? I mean, I think that these are people who, the people I interviewed specifically for this story today, are people who've fought, you know, for change. They have worked hard so that these things don't happen again, but they've seen very little change at the federal level. They, you know, 18-year-olds can still walk into a store and buy assault weapons, as President Biden pointed out. So that sort of sweeping change that that they hoped for but never came, they knew that it would result in a day like we had yesterday.
You've talked to people who have survived mass shootings. What did you learn, and not just high-profile ones, ones we probably never even read about as they happened, what did you learn about the impact on kids after they've gone through something like this and try to later have a normal life?
It's often hard to predict, you know, how a child will react, but in my experience, children have dealt with devastating trauma, lingering trauma. A group of children I wrote about in the book in South Carolina, they're still dealing with it 6 years later. They're still dealing with what they saw that day. And that was a school shooting that took one life and it lasted 12 seconds. And, you know, in one little girl's case, she has probably been to 8 or 9 different therapists since then. She's been diagnosed with debilitating PTSD. She can't go to school anymore. She's on antipsychotics and antidepressants. She has harmed herself, you know, picking at her elbow and pulling at her eyelashes and banging her head against the wall. And a lot of that stems from fear, but a lot of it also stems from guilt. Kids often come away from these events with a feeling of a real guilt that they should have done something to stop it, or that they should have helped their friend who died. You know, and a lot of these kids are not legally considered victims of anything. They're not, because they weren't physically harmed, but they absolutely are victims. And we know, too, that a huge number of children have been through school shootings in this country. And we have a database at the Post that tracks that very thing. And it dates all the way back to Columbine. In that period, since Columbine, at least 311,000 students have been exposed to gun violence on their campuses. It's a huge number, and a meaningful percentage of those kids are still struggling today.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut delivered a speech in the Senate urging fellow lawmakers to do something about these shootings and talked some about the experience of the kids in his own state.
In Sandy Hook Elementary School, after those kids came back into those classrooms, they had to adopt a practice in which there would be a safe word that the kids would say if they started to get thoughts in their brain about what they saw that day, if they started to get nightmares during the day, reliving stepping over their classmates' bodies as they tried to flee the school. In one classroom, that word was monkey. And over and over and over through the day, kids would stand up and yell, "Monkey!" And a teacher or a paraprofessional would have to go over to that kid, take them out of the classroom, talk to them about what they had seen, work them through their issues. Sandy Hook will never, ever be the same. This community in Texas will never, ever be the same.
What have you seen, John, about how schools like now, Uvalde in Texas, the kids are going to go back to school someday. The teachers are going to go back to school someday. How do they bring them back?
It's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly hard. You know, kids will be triggered by all sorts of things. Loud noises when they go back. They'll be triggered by sights that they've seen. They'll be triggered by smells. Getting kids to a point where they can actually be educated again, where they can learn, where they can figure out how to put numbers together and how to read is going to take a long time. Much of the transition back will just be trying to make them comfortable because some kids will be okay and then some kids won't. And when a kid has an outburst, it's going to affect other children too. So, there is often in the aftermath of these things, we see things like Parkland Strong or Sandy Hook Strong, and that's a noble thing. But also, sometimes it can imply that it's time to get over it, it's time to move on. And that is simply not how grief works. It's not how trauma works. These can take months and years for people to not just get back to some version of normal, but to actually be able to function at all. So that's what they're facing. They're facing a really long and difficult road back. And what they need are lots of therapists, lots of adults in their lives who love them, overwhelming support. And it can't end after 3 or 6 months. It needs to be a long-term commitment.
We're talking to John Woodrow Cox, reporter at the Washington Post, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis, looking at the impact of school shootings like the one in Uvalde, Texas yesterday on survivors, on parents of kids lost in those attacks. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. Let's bring on a caller now. Blake is with us in Madison. Blake, hi.
Hi. So I'm a person of color living in Madison. I'm 30 years old. I'm calling in because I want to say if people want change, they're going to have to do it themselves. The last 20 years of politics after Columbine have shown we can't expect progress at the state or federal level. 2 years after George Floyd, we don't have real police reform. Next year, we might see the end of abortion, gay marriage, and racial marriage in Wisconsin if a Republican governor is elected. I won't hold my breath on gun control or, gun laws being put into effect. People need to find their own outlet to enact change in their community. There's the Liberal Gun Club if people want safety, education, and outreach for parents in their community. There's NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. There's food banks. There's Boys and Girls Club. There's local politicians that we can talk to about affordable housing and living wages, health care.
Blake, I got you. A lot there. But, John, Blake's initial, it sounded like, I think, frustration with lack of change on issues related to guns, especially with the survivors, and the parents you've talked to. Are they sharing that sense of frustration?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Deep sense of frustration. And, because it's preventable. These aren't natural disasters. It's not a hurricane that showed up in Texas and killed 19 children. These are events that we can stop from happening. And we know they don't have to happen because they don't happen in any other developed nation. Children are not being routinely shot to death in schools in England and Canada and Australia. And when those events have occurred in those places, there has been rapid change, rapid reform. So it's not something that is inevitable, right? We could choose to do something differently. And that's what these activists, that's what these families understand, is that this is a choice that our society is making, that we're allowing these to happen over and over and over again.
We're talking about the aftermath of the elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, with Washington Post reporter John Woodrow Cox. He's talked to survivors and family members of past school shootings about their reactions, the long-term impact of these attacks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see these school shootings addressed? Have you lived through something like this yourself? 300,000 Americans plus have had an event like this in their school. Are you one of them? What did it change for you or maybe for a loved one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. We're picking up our conversation with Washington Post reporter John Woodrow Cox, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. He's with us today looking at the impacts of school shootings like the one yesterday at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. He has spoken with survivors and parents from past school shootings. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions, maybe your experiences. If you've been in a school as a teacher, a student in the last bunch of years, what are things like? 800-642-1234 when it comes to safety and precautions. Let's go back to your calls now. Sandra is with us in Milwaukee. Sandra, hi.
Hello. I am listening to this as a former educator in a couple of different schools and a teacher training faculty member. In one of the schools I taught at for a long time, I never thought that the students were at risk, even though there was a shooting nearby and my son was in that school. My principal let me go to get him and remove him from the school. The school was unlocked when there was someone with a gun traveling from school to school. The second school that I was in, another school that I was in, every single day I thought the children were at risk because of the very casual way the possibility of them being hurt was treated. To have a counselor be a part-time counselor and part-time security guard is completely unreasonable. One school that I volunteered in, I will tell you, they had at every entrance, this was a large Midwestern city with plenty of guns, at every entrance they had a metal detector. These metal detectors were not expensive, but you couldn't get into that school with a large umbrella without
Sandra,
them going off.
Thanks for the call. John, Sandra, seeing a variety of approaches to security at schools, talking to people who've worked on these issues and survived these shootings, do you have thoughts on what people are saying about various security measures?
Well, I can speak to that. I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions out there about security measures being able to ensure that shootings don't happen, and it's just not based on reality. There have been a great many shootings that have occurred at schools where there were metal detectors. There have been shootings at schools where there were multiple armed resource officers. There have been shootings at really every sort of school with any type of security that you can imagine. There is no sure way to guarantee that a child will not get a gun into a school or that an adult won't get a gun into a school. It's not to say that those security measures haven't helped in certain cases, or that things like training, that those can't be effective. We do know there are examples, but they are not guarantees of safety by any stretch, because we know there have been shootings in all those environments. You know, what we do know is that if the one thing that had changed after Columbine is that adults with guns locked up their firearms and did not allow those firearms to fall into the hands of children, if that was the only change that we made, well more than half of the school shootings in America would not have happened since Columbine. They just wouldn't have happened if we just made that one simple change. So, you know, the one commonality in every single school shooting is the gun. School shooting cannot happen without the gun. And there is no good excuse for a child getting access to a gun and shooting up a school. Certainly, you know, in this case, the shooter bought the gun legally. But in many cases, that's not the case. Children get guns from home. They get guns from friends. They get guns in ways that they shouldn't. And you know, seldom are the negligent gun owners held accountable.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to John Woodrow Cox, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis, looking at what happens in the aftermath of school shootings like the one at an elementary school yesterday in Uvalde, Texas. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Madison. Aaron, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking the call, and great to hear John on the line here. But you know, we talk about what's been done, you know, after these school shootings happened, and it's clear that it's basically nothing at this point. And I think, you know, I really hope that folks here in Wisconsin understand that the decisions that we make as far as who we put in office does have an impact on kids in Texas. And how we can have a direct impact is by making sure that we don't have buffoons in office that are only concerned with themselves and their own power, like Ron Johnson, and get the right folks in there that'll actually solve these problems and help to move us forward.
Aaron, thanks for the call. John, do you have thoughts on the politics that have emerged just in the last day over this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, your caller is not wrong. It, you know, there is this sense that Americans are deeply divided on gun reform, gun safety reform, gun policy, and it is not true. Polls consistently show that 90% plus of Americans support things like universal background checks. There's widespread support for a lot of other gun policies as well. There's a perception that, you know, America is 50-50 on guns. That's not true. Where there is deep division is in the Senate on Capitol Hill. You know, there are a handful of Americans in the Senate deciding for all Americans what our gun policies will be. And much of that is certainly driven by financial interest. It's driven by the influence of the gun lobby. Because no one could argue that the Senate is voting precisely according to what Americans want. They're not. There's just been a complete unwillingness among Republican senators to consider any really gun reform. And that was certainly true after Sandy Hook. And I don't see a reason why it would be different today.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll talk more about the politics of gun control here on Central Time coming up on Friday afternoon. John, what kind of support do people need now? The parents who just waited to find out whether they lost a child yesterday, the kids who survived, and as you say, are going to deal with that survivor guilt that they probably don't even understand. What kind of resources, in your experience, do they need the most right now?
They need a lot of opportunity to seek counseling and therapy. I mean, it's a simple thing, but it is critically important. And what that means is, you know, the state needs to fund, and nonprofits, whoever, needs to fund dozens of therapists to show up there, and not just, you know, remotely. They need physically people who are there, and that costs money, and it's an investment, but that's what they need. They need that opportunity. Not everybody will be ready right away, and some people won't ever be ready, but they need the opportunity to seek that sort of help if they need it. And they need, too, is they need patience. They need the rest of the world, their family and friends who aren't there, and the other communities around them to be patient, because there is a very sort of American ideal that, you know, in 6 months, let's get over this and move on. And that is just not the way it works for a great many people.
And John, if I may ask, on a personal level, you, I think, tweeted recently, you've been covering this issue almost exclusively between your reporting and your book, this issue of, you know, what happens to people after school shootings for 5 years now. There's enough of a beat here that it occupies your time. When you see those first headlines break, the first things come up on social media, that there's another one, what goes through your mind?
I mean, I feel sick. You know, I felt sick yesterday. It's gutting, because, and I know what those people are headed toward. You know, I know all the pain that they're going to endure, not just this week, but for years, for the rest of their lives. You know, these people will never be who they were, ever. They can't be. It's impossible because someone is gone, a child is gone, and it is. It's incredibly painful, and it's deeply frustrating because I feel, you know, also that it's not. It doesn't have to be this way. America is making a choice, and I hope and pray that we'll make a different choice.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's John Woodrow Cox, enterprise reporter at The Washington Post, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. He was with us today looking at the lasting impacts of school shootings like the one yesterday in Uvalde, Texas. You can keep following the latest news. We've got stories from NPR at WPR.org. And again, we'll talk more about the politics of gun violence, gun safety, and gun control. That'll be coming up Friday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we take a look at the state of police reform on the 2-year anniversary of George Floyd's death at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer. Two pieces of news out this week from the federal government when it comes to police use of force, when federal agents have to intervene if they see officers from other agencies using unnecessary force, also working with local police departments on those issues. As always, we'll invite your calls. We'll be hearing from a former longtime police chief here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a UW-Madison study that puts a number on how many lives air pollution costs each year. Now, 2 years ago today, Minneapolis resident George Floyd was murdered by a police officer, setting off protests around the globe against police violence toward Black people and other marginalized groups. Here's then candidate Joe Biden's address to the nation in 2020 a few days later.
Looking ahead in the first 100 days of my presidency, I've committed to creating a National Police Oversight Commission. I've long believed we need real community policing. We need each and every police department of the country to understand a comprehensive review of their undertake a comprehensive review of their hiring, their training, their de-escalation. Some have already done it. Some are in the process of doing it. The federal government should give the cities and states the tools and the resources they need to implement reforms. More police officers meet the higher standards of their profession. Most of them do it. All the more reason why bad cops should be dealt with severely and swiftly.
Two pieces of news came out this week on the topic. A new executive order from the Biden administration on the use of force by federal agents with guidance for local departments, and a Justice Department mandate that federal officers should intervene if they see excessive use of force from other law enforcement officers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on what's changed, what hasn't changed over the last 2 years? What kind of changes would you like to see still? Do you have questions about what we're hearing from the Biden administration this week? Do you work in law enforcement? Has anything changed in your department over the last couple of years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Reverend David Cooper joins us now. He served 33 years as a police officer, 21 of those as Madison's chief of police. After his retirement, he was ordained as a priest in the Episcopal Church. He's the author of the book Arrested Development, The Colors That Divide Us, about race and police reform. He has a blog called Improving Police. Reverend Cooper, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Always nice to be on public radio.
Before we get into some of the specifics from the Biden administration, have you seen significant changes in the way policing is done in the last couple of years since the death of George Floyd?
Well, I think probably most white people would say, oh, yeah, there must be a lot of changes going on. But I think sort of the proof of the pudding here is, you know, how do people of color, you know, see what's happened the last 2 years? And if I'm to be fair, I think I have to look at, it's been a lot of talk. People mean well, and I'm sure the president does. I'm sure every public official, I think City Council of Minneapolis and Mayor Fry certainly speaks very strongly about the need for improvement. And I think it's we're talking about a transformation, and anything we're talking about is going to take this entire nation getting behind some very strong principles and saying this is the kind of police that we want in our democracy, and we have to make those changes. And it's going to take 20 years. It took me 20 years in Madison. It's going to take any system, probably a good, well, I'll be fair. We probably made some changes significant after 8 years. It takes time. It takes leadership. It takes people committed to really be strong values about what this country is and our values about people.
We have from the Biden administration an executive order today. It's going to require federal agencies to change, revise their use of force policies, give incentives to local departments to do that with use of force, especially when officers intentionally use potentially deadly force. What's our current state of affairs? What do you think needs to change?
Well, you know, it's very nice that we have this from the Attorney General. I'm sure everybody means well. All the things that we've talked about in the last 2 years since George Floyd was so brutally murdered on the streets of Minneapolis has been done in one way or another by progressive police departments 40, 50 years ago. This is not new. The Madison Police Department has, since the early 1970s, had a policy that we implemented, said that officers are responsible to step in if they see bad behavior, illegal behavior, policy violations from their fellow officers. We also prohibited the shooting at fleeing motor vehicles and had a procedure to stop high-speed chases that were just getting too dangerous. This is about chokeholds. We decided that we are going to prohibit those in those early days as well. So for someone who's, you know, been in policing for since 1960 and has watched the field and kept an eye on what's going on, and the kind of commitment that I have both as a police officer and a priest to see justice in this country, it is amazing that that this has not been, you know, standard practice. So even the executive order from the Attorney General talks about officers' duty to intervene in any officer. Well, I think there needs to be a definition. Is the Attorney General talking about federal police officers, Secret Service, FBI, Bureau of ATF? Are those does it just mean within those federal officers, or are we going to expect federal officers who are at a scene of, say, a demonstration to step in when police officers are using force illegally against a crowd of protesters? That's going to be a very interesting situation if that's what he means.
Talking to Reverend David Cooper, former Madison Chief of Police for over 20 years, looking at policing in America over the last 2 years since the death of George Floyd. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reverend Cooper, we've talked in the past and you've written a lot about the role of a police officer, the mentality they do their job with, and that's trained into them. Is it guardian or is it warrior? And you worry that it slipped from guardian to warrior. Can you talk about that distinction?
Absolutely. That's been a visible shift probably since 9/11. I think there's been significant shift. There's been a lot of outside trainers going around the country. In fact, there's even a course that many police officers in the country have taken called killology. And it is outrageous that this is the kind of training that taxpayers are paying for their police to have. We also, you know, I've been arguing for quite a few years now that we take the European Union standard of deadly force use, and I see that word was not used. I think the Attorney General talks about use force when necessary. The EU standard, and all EU nations must sign on to this, is that the use of deadly force can only be when it is an absolute necessity. Absolute necessity. And I think that's got to be the standard. It certainly involves de-escalation. It certainly involves police officers being better trained as good mental health workers on the street, because you can't be an urban police officer, well, any police officer almost in any town and city, and not really have a part of your job is to be a mental health officer, because a lot of the people in which you're contacting and having interactions with are suffering from mental illness. And I think that's a very, very important part of the job. And to sort of shift this work now, say, okay, now police don't know how to do that very well, so we're going to have mental health workers coming into the situation where we would normally send police. And then certainly goes through my mind is, you know, a lot of people are armed today. We certainly know that all too well. And once they have a run into a mentally ill person with a gun, they're going to have to call the police. So I think the job of a police officer is to be a mental health worker as well. And I've always had a high belief in the importance of police to be sort of a social glue in our society. Well-trained police officers who are educated, have high emotional intelligence, are continually trained, led by mature leaders, are respectful to everyone they come in contact with, and are willing to work with community members in solving the problems that community members identify as important in their communities. That is possible. I think we have done that in Madison. I think that that it is a goal that's attainable. Nobody wants to be a police officer today. They didn't when I was hiring in the 60s and 70s as well. One of the things we talked about is, come, we're going to be a domestic peace corps. And you don't like the police? Well, join us. Join us and help us change, because nobody outside can change the police. And that is a very, very true maxim. You can't change the police from the outside. The police have to want to change.
Reverend David Cooper is with us, retired police officer, including 21 years as Madison's chief of police. You can join the conversation about policing in America over the last 2 years since the death of George Floyd. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Do you want to see changes in police training, in transparency? Does the lead have to come from the federal government, or do you see hope for positive changes at the local level? What questions do you have for a guest about the changes he's calling for? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Reverend David Cooper, retired police officer, former chief of police in Madison, author of the book Arrested Development, about policing reform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in New Glarus. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, I just wanted to mention it. I was a Chicago police officer, and I worked an all-black district, and my partner was black. His first name was Tim. That's the only name I'm going to give you. But he was 7 feet tall and weighed over 300 pounds, and I felt pretty safe working a two-man car with him. He was, I'm sure, kept me going for quite a while. But he walked in, he was off duty, and he walked into a bar down the block from where he lived. He walked into the bar, and It was an all black neighborhood, and the people in the bar were all black, and the one guy in the bar pulled out a gun and shot and killed my partner. And he said, "That's what you get for working for Whitey." And I just wanted to say, you know, you would think after all these years, I mean, I'm 77 years old now. We're talking about something that happened 50 years ago. We haven't gotten any better. We haven't developed. We haven't grown any better. We're still just, I don't know what to say.
Steve, thank you for sharing your story. I'm sorry about the loss of your partner. I can tell you're still feeling it today. Reverend Cooper, Steve feels like the divide, the suspicion, I think, between police and black communities, not any better than when he was a cop.
Yeah, I think he's right. I think he's very right. And it's a sad commentary for those of us who have sort of, you know, watched this field and have served in this field. I certainly felt that when I retired in the 1990s, that that the die was cast and that we as a nation would continue to improve. But I think right now, but there's one positive thing I think coming out as Assistant Attorney General Gupta. She said that that there's, and I'm going to do some research on this. I just found out this just earlier today, that there's having a knowledge lab and that they're trying to develop best practices in the police field, which I think is really good. But we're also talking about 18,000 separate police agencies in 50 states and about 600,000 police officers with all kinds of variations in standards for their hiring. It is seemingly an insurmountable problem, even when we were sort of willing to dialogue between left and right in this country. Now that everyone has sort of run to the side that either the police are all bad or the police are all good and leave them alone, they're just doing their job, we never will have that dialogue that I think is so essential in the middle to try to come to some agreement as to, you know, what are the, you know, the standards and conditions and training and what are the kind of people we want. And I used to, in fact, I noted this, I think in my book, I talked about, we had a citizens panel interviewing a number of police officers over the years, sort of kind of a final approval of having the community involved and not just the government officials in selecting police. And I remember one person on the panel saying, well, Chief, you know, what are you looking for? What kind of person do you want in the police department? And the story I gave them was this. I said, imagine your teenage daughter has 2 hours late coming home and you're up, you and your wife are up and worried about this and maybe thinking about, well, should we call the police? And all of a sudden she's knocking at the door. She comes in, she's crying. She's been beaten up. Now, what kind of person do you want to come into your home, in your living room, and try to sort this out and help find out what's happened to her? That's the kind of police officer that I think this country needs. And I think we've got a lot of them out there. They're very reluctant to speak up because the subculture in which police work is overpowering. It changes people. It's difficult to go up against what you think is the stream. But the reality is there's more good cops out there than there's bad cops. And Derek Chauvin was a bad cop. And there's not a whole bunch of bad cops like that in Minneapolis. I worked there for 7 years when I started my career. But what there is a lot of other police officers that will not stand up and challenge, you know, a senior opinion leader like Derek Chauvin within a police department. They simply won't do it. Call it survival. It just doesn't happen very often.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us on the road near Madison. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I could probably agree with some of the things the gentleman is commenting on. Some of it I don't. But just to give you some perspective from my point of view, I spent 38 years in law enforcement. 31 of those years, I was a street police officer in a major metropolitan city in the Midwest. A big city that is having many problems today. The last years of my career, of that 38 years, I spent specifically working in police training. In that period of time, I did find, from my perspective, a lot of problems with the methodology, the new methodology in police training. Most of it was good, but some of it was bad. And what I would refer to as far as use of force is concerned, a lot of the technological aspects of the training, the shoot, don't shoot stuff and all that kind of stuff, I did not agree with, and I made it known to my superiors, fell on deaf ears. And I think in a lot of big organizations, the institutional thinking is the ideas from the bottom never get to the top. There's this kind of, you know, pecking order kind of thing. And the gentleman making the comments there, he made the references that there's institutional thinking where, you know, you've got people that kind of set the tone of things and the other people are afraid to comment on it. I didn't find that to be the case much. It did in some areas. But, you know, what I think is happening today also is that the police departments are getting beat up constantly. Okay, they're getting beat up in the media. They're getting beat up by civic organizations and all these other entities on the outside. So it creates that circle of wagons mentality within police organizations. Also, I will say...
I'm going to jump in, Jim, because we don't have too much time left, and you gave us a lot to talk about there. Reverend Cooper, you've written that you're hoping to see not such, I think, correct me if I'm not paraphrasing you right, not such a confrontational approach, you know, community against police, federal government consent decrees against a department, more of a collaborative approach so that, as Jim says, we don't circle the wagons so much. Can you talk about how to do that?
I'd be interested in him identifying what he doesn't agree with what I said. That would be interesting to see that we may have had careers along parallel times, some overlapping there. I'm probably a little older than he is, but you know, what is it that Jim thinks that should not be done here, that we're barking up the wrong tree? I'd be interested. Changes in use of force policies, you know, what about, you know, getting a hold of guns? You know, there's some way that we can, you know, regulate guns like we have automobiles. Is there some way we can have smart weapons? There's technology out there that'll prevent a person from firing a firearm that isn't his or her own. Some of that is that going to have to be done because there's far too many guns on the street. And I would put it right out there. There's too many guns out there, and guns kill cops, and cops should be very much involved in trying to regulate the number of guns that are out there and who's carrying them. That's an important part. You know, how many children do we get shot in school? You know, I'm sick and tired of it, and most everyone is. Let's do something.
Jim, thanks for that call. Reverend Cooper, in just our last few moments, do you have any optimism that more departments are going to make some of the changes that you've been hoping for?
Well, my faith tells me to have hope, that as a person of faith, I will always have hope. As a former police leader watching the field for all these years and watching what's gone on since 2020, I will have to say that I am very, very worried that we will not be able to, in the near future, make the necessary change to have police officers who are then respected by the communities they serve and supported by them. Because a police officer in America cannot do his or her job without having trust and support from the community. It is impossible. That's how you turn into a warrior, you know, where the objective is to use fear and intimidation.
And that's
good policing involves community.
That's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Reverend David Cooper, retired police officer, former Madison chief of police for over two decades, author of the book Arrested Development, The Colors That Divide Us. talked on the show about what's been called the Great Resignation, with lots of people quitting or changing their jobs. It's still going on, apparently, and tomorrow our guest asked the question, what if the Great Resignation never ends? And we want to hear your story. You can get started right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Have you changed jobs over the last couple of years, or are you planning to? Have you changed your career? If so, what led you to seek a new path? Did you leave the job world altogether, maybe as an early retirement? Or are you happy where you are and you're going to stay there? And if you're an employer, what are you seeing? Share your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll hear more. Share some of your stories coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.